This episode of Super Pulp Science is brought to you by Tilt, the Sweet Science of Pinball, a new web series that shares in the transformative power of pinball with a champion who reveals the inner workings of the game. Season 1 now available to stream for free at tiltpinball.show.
Attention, citizens! It's time for Super Pulp Science!
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. I am your host, Gregory Kamichuk. I am here with my long-suffering co-host, Justin Curry, also known online and around the world as Chasing Artwork. We've also brought Michael Sanders, filmmaker, producer, photographer, to talk to us about a genre film that he is currently trying to get made. Thanks for being with us, Michael.
Hi.
The Terse Award goes to... So just before we started recording, I reminded Justin about what it is we might be talking about today. And tell me what it was that you said, Justin, about our ceiling.
We still have blood on the ceiling at the studio, and there's still a whole bunch of tacks up there too, I just noticed.
Mike, can you please explain yourself? Why do we have blood on the ceiling of our very nice downtown studio? And why are there tacks running up along the side? It's right out of reach, just at the seam where the ceiling and our 10 or 12 foot ceilings, I guess, and what have we got, 15 maybe.
Am I responsible for the tacks as well? Is that what?
I think a director is always responsible for all elements of their film, aren't they?
Yeah, I guess, yes.
Yeah, so... The great thing about me only being a writer on that project is that everything else is your fault.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So what are you asking me? To defend myself?
No, I just want you to, for the dear listener's sake, to explain a little bit of context. Why don't you tell them about the 24-Hour Film Festival in brief, and then what we attempted to do, and then you can maybe give us a brief explanation of how you built the blood cannon.
Well, the 40-Hour Film Fest was run through the Winnipeg Film Group. And now Ben Williams, who was running it, has kind of broken it off and is doing his own thing with it. So you basically write, produce a film in 48 hours. You make a film, cut it, shoot it, cut it, deliver it 48 hours. And so we did it a few years ago. We've done it twice, once successfully and one not so successfully. So I think the one with the blood on the ceiling I know that was the successful one. That was the one we actually finished in 48 hours. We did one then I think a year or two later that became Love Song that we didn't finish in 48 hours. We ended up spending much, much longer on that film. But
and this film, Rock, Paper, Scissors, or Paper, Rock, Scissors. How did you do
it? I don't remember what the original title of it was. So we shot it and we cut it. It had to be 3 minutes. So we cut it down to 3 minutes. And I think it was like the writer, it was like 2.5 or 3 something. It was really a really, really short amount of time.
It was ridiculously short. And we made a genre film that included a number of locations, shots in moving vehicles, a visual effect, a practical effect, and a musical score, all created within that same 48-hour window. And just for the dear listener's point of view, basically once we hit the start line, we gave, and you correct any part that I'm misremembering, but we gave sort of the concept to someone to then go off and start making music for. We gave the concept to the visual effects person that we came up with right then, that then they started putting together. And then we already had a prop produced for it, the blood cannon.
Yeah, we made a prop ahead of time, and I think we even dressed a set on the Thursday night. where we just like, which was your office. We in your studio, we just put up the plastic. We put up plastic sheeting all over the walls.
Yeah. The only thing we did ahead of time was make sure that when that thing went off, it didn't ruin a life's work of artwork in the studio.
Yeah.
And when you guys are coming up with this idea, before you even start brainstorming, do you kind of make a list of locations and assets that you have prior to really going down the rabbit hole of ideas?
Yeah, we knew we wrote it around very specific locations that we had access to.
Right.
Like we knew we were at somebody's house, and then we knew we could use the studio.
Yeah, I used a house, a buddy of mine, I used his house for the opening, and we started there. I think we started shooting Friday at 5. We finished sometime around 3 a.m. on Friday. We shot everything on Friday night, if I remember correctly.
That's
I think
right.
We shot the whole thing on Friday night. We got everything in the can by 3 a.m. and then I slept for 2 or 3 hours and then started editing, I think at like 6 a.m. or 8 a.m. or something.
Yeah, and then editing and sound and VFX all were sleeping in shifts, like a couple hours at a time. Like I'll do my part, then I'll take a nap, then you do your part while you're while I take a nap. It was pretty wild.
Yeah, just worked through the cut and then tried to get, I think what we did was we did a rough during the day and then we did sort of a fine cut at night. And we had already started, we had one VFX shot that we started on that day and that took all day and all night. And then the edit, and I think we went, like I finished, I remember editing all night long. Like I think we edited and we finished sometime around just in the morning on Sunday. Then I had a bunch of output issues and we had a bunch of just regular film making bullshit happen at the end, and then got it out and delivered by noon or whatever. Like I delivered it 15 minutes before the deadline or something like that, and it was super fun. It was awesome, and it was it's a great like mental. It's a great filmmaking boot camp. It's a great tool to focus. Like the constraint of the time is so extreme that you can't help but focus down on what needs to be done. So in that respect, it's really cool.
I'd like to add to that too, that it was a great exercise in doing the best with what you have, because you don't always know what you're going to get when you're being thrown into a creative situation. And so it was a great almost a proof of concept for our little team to know that we could pull it off under really, really awful conditions. You know, like if someone came to you and said, you've got 48 hours, you have to make it an entire, you know, you're going to shoot this scene, it's 5 minutes long with a VFX musical cue. And you would say those people are insane. It's impossible to do.
It's not impossible to do, but like I said, like I'm sure Mark, who works with me, other people that have worked there have heard me say, there is a $100,000 version of Titanic. You know?
That's right. Yeah,
you know, it's not the same film by any stretch of the imagination, but you can make a $10,000 Titanic. It's not
$10,000 Titanic is you, me, and that door in a duck pond. Right, the boat's already sank, and I'm like, "There's room on here for us both," and you won't let me up. That's our $10,000 version.
I think that's what's fun about it is that the expectations are to a certain extent, the expectations are so low. So, you know, the bar is low. Like no one expects you to produce some groundbreaking, mind-bending short. It's gonna be something fun and are you able to sort of apply sort of filmmaking fundamentals to it to make it a fun story or an interesting film to watch?
I'd like to go on a limb and say that we did manage to make a mind-bending, pretty great little story. It has the virtue of being set in a surreal environment. So the parts that don't make sense seem on purpose instead of just confusing bad filmmaking.
Speak of the earth creatures. They are second-age subhuman, weak and full of fright. Speak of their blood. It may be as ours. I have sent to you 30 cubits for study. There must be more.
You know, when we cut that film, it was only 3 minutes. And I always sort of had sort of this idea in my head that it could be longer. And the more time I've had away from it, and just some of the stuff I've been reading and listening to and that kind of stuff has really made me see what we shot and the and that story that we sort of shot in a much different light. Like, I have a better understanding now of what it means and what, and than I ever did when we shot it. And some of the synchronicities that line up in the film and just thematic things I think are interesting and worked out. So I've been looking for an excuse to do a few VFX shots in house and just sort of stretch our skills there a little bit. So we've gone back in, and there's a couple shots in the film that we're revisiting as VFX shots. And then I've sort of made two or three attempts in the last year to recut it and failed miserably all of those times. And
can I just make it clarifying? It's both an observation and a question for the sake of the listener and myself. What do you as a filmmaker believe is the value of revisiting an old project like this and reassembling it? Why? I think a person who is not too familiar with the process of these things, their first thought would probably be go shoot something new and try again.
Well, I'd love to be able to go and shoot something new and try again, but I can't go out and shoot anything right now.
Right. So this was you
starting a production under the current restrictions. So we were able to finish a production we started at the beginning of last year before the lockdown, but we weren't able to start a new one. So we're waiting right now to start on another production. And we've got a couple short films we want to try to get done this year too. So it's just, we can't start anything new. And I would say it's the process is the reason to go back and do it. And the challenge of making something new out of old material, I think is interesting to me. Just because I'm about to start a feature documentary edit, and this was meant to be a palate cleanser before I got into that. I was like, well, you know, maybe I'll take one more shot at it and just have some fun with it. And it'll be a nice thing I can get done quickly. And then I'll go into this 6 month long edit that I'm about to undertake. So I sort of started with what, you know, I started thinking about it again. I went back and revisited my notes. And then I just spent a bit of time looking for music because I kind of always felt that the missing piece was the music. And I just happened upon these three tracks that are just perfect. And I recut, so it's like three movements. And then I started recutting to the music, and it's the best it's ever felt. It's the weirdest it's ever felt.
And yeah, that clip you sent me was real nice. So listener's sake, the story is basically about this guy who receives a message that he is available, or he has been selected for a job interview that he didn't know he had. And when he goes to the place, along the way, he keeps seeing this umbrella in non sequitur appearances that kind of let the viewer know that things are strange. And when he arrives there, he is involved in the weirdest job interview you could imagine, which is essentially a mixture of a Rorschach test and a tarot reading all mixed into one.
Yeah.
And based on his answers, he gets the job. We see him take over the job of interviewer, and I don't know how much longer or later it is, but it's sometime later. And when someone else fails the job interview, their head explodes and this weird creature occupant has been identified through this evaluation process, covering our studio in fake brain matter and also giving us a chance to put a alien creature effect as a visual effect at the end.
Well, but the alien creature effect wasn't in the original cut. The alien creature effect, it was a fun thing to do for one of my 3D artists who wanted to play around with some film stuff. So I was like, hey man, if you want to do this, I'd like tentacles hanging out of this guy's exploded head. Is that something we could maybe try to do?
Can I ask a music question before we get too far away from it? When you film something, you obviously can't call up your music guy and say, come up with 10 different tracks for this scene. As an editor, do you just have a huge library of other like movie soundtracks and you just play around with those to get a sense of the tone? Or like how does that process work before the final cut?
It's been a bit, it's been different. I've tried something different on every project. So I've done like, I've cut the whole project to temp score and then had that temp score replaced.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes comes first?
This is the first time I've had score first.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's kind of part of what I wanted to try because, you know, when I was younger, I would cut stuff to music all the time primarily and like much younger. but I haven't really had that luxury.
Or Mr. Sanders saw his life flash before his eyes right then.
Yeah. I did the first like major doc project that I cut was a music doc, and we had music in the edit that we would always be using to form sequences, and that was really helpful. And then the second project I did, I used temp score, and I actually found some music that I really, really loved, and I cut huge sections of that doc with that music, and then when we went to clear that music, it just was out of our budget. And so I went and found I couldn't use the original track. So I went and tried to clear covers. So basically someone had covered the music. It was the soundtrack to The Third Man, which is an Orson Welles film. And so someone had actually done a more recent recording of that music in the early 2000s, and it sounded great. And even that was out of our ballpark. Like we couldn't even afford that. So
just for the sake of the dear listener that doesn't understand how clearance works for music, just very briefly break that down for someone.
Well, so we need the right to sync the music with the picture for the film. That's basically what you're paying for, is a sync license. That's what it's called. And basically if you don't have at least $5,000, you're not clearing anything recognizable. And if it's really recognizable, you can probably triple or quadruple that amount on a minimum basis, you know? And that may not even be to use it in your title. That may just be to use it for a couple minutes in one part of the film. And so this music was, they weren't gonna do it for less than $5,000 because basically all that music, there's a huge amount of music owned by Warner's Chappell. And they probably represent, I don't know what it's like now, but back then when I was clearing that kind of stuff, it was like they had 90% of the market. So any music track you wanted to clear that was like an actual music track, not custom score, but music that another artist had made, it's probably, that publishing is probably handled by Warner's Chappell. So their lawyers aren't getting out of bed apparently for less than $5,000 to give you a sync license. So, right. You know, it's
on an independent film or on a modestly budgeted documentary. It's not worth it.
And I'm sure like that's not a lot of money, but it is a lot of money to a project that has zero money. So, you know, if it's like a self-funded project and you're not even paying yourself, and then, you know, you got other expenses, not least of which is your insurance costs to get the film to a distributor, you know, $5,000 on music is a hard bite sometimes. So what we ended up doing was spending that money locally with friends of ours who were musicians, and they did a whole custom soundtrack for me.
I was just going to say, you could find an independent musician and say, yeah, I have $5,000 for you to make me some original music, yeah, but then they would own in the end, is a pretty good deal for them.
Yeah, so Kat Yonke and Darren Johnson did that music for us and ended up doing the music, like, and then Darren did the edit and did the music edit and the mix and everything for me. And it was a better way to spend that money. But but I've never really had music's always important. Like it's always the you know, sound's half the film, so music mm-hmm. half of that half, if not more. You know.
Yeah, and you're not being facetious there when you say sound is half the film. That's I think that any person that's ever watched a low budget film and said, "Oh man, that felt so cheap," what they're not realizing is the part that felt
Oh, absolutely. I forget who it is, and I think I've said it to you before, but the audience will forgive a low res image, but they will not forgive shitty sound.
Deep apologies to all of our listeners who've stuck with us through the pandemic and all of our shitty sound quality problems. This is our moment to just say to you, thank you so much. We love you.
Hello. What are you doing?
I actually tried to do, I cut a doc a couple of years ago. I did it without any music. I did the entire edit visually. I cut it just with visual, just to like the visual rhythm, the rhythm in the shots and that kind of stuff. And that was the hardest, that was the hardest edit I'd ever done. And then I had some musicians score a picture on that. So I just gave them the locked edit and they would write music to the locked edit. And then I'd get like, roughs back. I'd lay them in, I'd show them what it sounded like with it. I'd maybe move a couple things around, show them how that worked. And then they'd make an adjustment. And that was great. I thought that music turned out really good. So, and then the last doc I did, don't think I cut with music at all, but it has a lot of dialogue. There's a natural rhythm to the shots. I didn't really feel like I needed it necessarily. And that was all scored to picture in the end as well.
So I'd like to observe that the same part of you that is brought along on a musical journey, a symphonic wonderland, there's a different part of your brain that says, let's build a do-it-yourself blood cannon that can make it seem like real brain matter is coming out of a person. How do you square those two sides of yourself? And can you fill the dear listener in on just what the heck I'm talking about?
Well, yeah, I mean,
awkward.
You have to wear so many hats.
And one of them is covered in gore.
I don't know. I've always wanted to build a blood cannon, so we built a blood cannon. I also really appreciate good music, so I don't know. I don't even know why I would have to square those two. They seem to me to be, you know, two sides of the same coin, to be honest. But
we used as a bit of an anchor image to begin the film a clip of Roger Corman's Not of This Earth, his 1957 version, which is in the public domain, so that we could use a clip and have that music and you have to worry about clearances. And so it's interesting to me because he was him and his team were, you know, original do-it-yourselfers on shoestring budget.
Yeah.
Tell us about building this thing and what goes into it and what was, you know, this was an element that you brought to me. You're like, we're going to make this story out. We want to use this thing that figure out a way to spray blood and brains all over the end of the story.
Yeah. I figured that was, you know, I like to learn about how all sorts of people make movies. So I love Roger Corman for nothing less than is just, you know, tenacity and making films for no money. So I figure if you're going to be stuck making films for no money, there's no better person to study on what to do than Roger Corman. But, you know, something that I knew was an achievable effect for us would be a blood effect where the blood or the viscera is entering into frame from off camera. And so, you know, a blood cannon is just a 2-inch piece of plastic tubing hooked up to an air compressor and with a valve on it. And so you open the valve to let the pressure through and you pack that tube full of, we packed it full of homemade blood, oatmeal and bananas. And that's just a recipe I Googled. I literally Googled fake brain matter and found a recipe for oatmeal bananas and blood, and it's gross. It looks like brain matter.
Yeah, it looks disgusting, but it's actually smells nice and is quite nutritious.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And you know, so I just, yeah, I don't know, I just wanted to do that effect. It was something that we could do. I knew we could build something like that for nothing. You know, I got buddies that have air compressors, so it's like you just hook a tube up to it, that's all you're doing. So you can build the, you, it's like 20 30 40 bucks maybe in parts to actually get the hosing and the tube right from Home Depot, and it maybe cost us 10 bucks to make the blood and the bananas and oatmeal. And but we tested it the day before. We built it a week ahead of time, and I remember testing it at my buddy's house on the side of his garage, and like, and then on the day shooting, like, I was like, okay, like, you get a feel for it, because I knew I was gonna have to be the one that pointed it at the actor's face. Like, there was no way, like, I have to be that guy. So I tried it to get a sense for the valve opening and closing and what that was going to feel like and how much pressure is it going to throw, and what is, you know, you try to get a sense of the area that it's going to cover. And then I remember on the night, and like, the actor is a good friend of mine, so, you know, we had an agreement and he knew what he was getting himself into, and he's wearing Tyvek. Like, the funny thing is that in the story, the person conducting the interview at a certain point is wearing a protective garment and like Tyvek with safety goggles, because they know that if it is a monster in there, a head's going to roll or explode and they're going to be covered in shit. So
we wrote into the scene the idea that he's wearing all this protective gear so that we could shoot it right at his face, and there's really no danger. His eyes are safe.
No danger. And he's also a friend of mine who's known for having a very weak stomach. And so I was a bit concerned that I figured he'd be able to keep it together for at least long enough to get the end of the take, right? If he needed to barf, he could do it like 20 seconds after. He could maybe hold it.
Although, let's face it, that would have made a great scene too.
I remember, like, that was the last shot that we did, right? That was the very last shot we did, and we had just, so it's been like this epic.
We didn't have enough time to clean up after, so like, we'd lose so much time resetting the scene that we just had to do it.
So I remember it felt like, okay, we're at the end of this really long day, and this is the shot. Like, we're only gonna get one shot at this. So if it doesn't work, or it's not big enough, if it, like, my fear wasn't that it was gonna be too much. My fear was that what was gonna come out of this cannon was gonna be half a piece, a tiny piece of banana, and like a spattering of blood. And that's all that was gonna happen. And so I remember going, okay, I think we've got to pack this thing with more than what I'd been doing in the test. Just to be sure, I think we should double the load, you know?
Yeah, so last minute, you're changing the formula around.
Yeah, last minute, we're changing the formula. And I'm totally, at the same time, conscious of that is not always the best way to go. If it doesn't work now, it's my own fault, right? Like, there's no one to blame but myself. And so we did it, and like, I let it, I, you know, we did the countdown, and I opened it up, and like, it covered him. Like, it looked like a body. It looked like a body exploded. It didn't. Like, there's a lot. Yeah, it was a lot. It was good though. It worked perfectly. And he was, you can see him in the take, like jump ever so slightly. But then he held it together and even gave us like a line reading. Like, it was the perfect take, right?
It was a good solid take. Now, I remember sending a text to you, I believe, Jess, or something to that regard. Like, listen, if you find blood in the studio, it's fake. And, you know, don't worry.
Which is exactly what you would say had you just murdered somebody and were trying to throw me off the trail.
That's so true, to lull you into false insecurity. Yeah, if you really want to get up to nefarious stuff, you get people convinced that you make short films, and then you can get away with all kinds of things. That reminds me of the time we had that fake body for Agrosomnia, Mike.
Oh yeah, I remember Buddy taking it out of the, Colin took it out on his shoulder to put it in the back of the car.
Yeah, in the big guy, Colin takes this fake body. So it's a body with sandbags
It's a bag with sandbags in it.
It's a bag with sandbags on it, wrapped up in a cloth that, like you would if you were trying to dispose of a body. But the reason we put the sandbags is so that it would have the weight, so that it would be heavy when you lifted it, and it would have the right shape, and then you would have to strain to lift it. And so, because it was heavy, Colin, who we nicknamed Big Guy because he's a big guy, it's no big deal. He carries his body out to the truck, flops it head first into the trunk, and then flips the legs in, and then turns, and there's about a half a dozen city workers just staring at him, just like convinced that they've witnessed some heinous crime. And a few of them, I think, went for their cell phones. And rather than explain himself, he just gave them a grimace, shrugged, and then went back inside. I think that the fact that it said the name of the studio and the film production in front is probably why we were not immediately arrested. But it does beg the question as to why we were not immediately arrested.
Well, I think people assume they must be seeing things.
There's no doubt in my mind that this woman is something other than human. She's an alien.
I see.
I'm going to create a thought experiment for you, Mike. Tomorrow, you've got 48 hours to shoot a film. You can bring a few things with you. What are those things that you're bringing with you?
But am I limited in how many things? Or
you're you. You have a working studio. I'd like you to identify the tools. I'd like you to identify the tools that you already have. Like, what would you bring with you if you were forced right now?
I would take the camera. I would take the big camera, the little camera.
You want to name drop those things for the Googlers?
We should have a black mag. I would take the Ursa Mini Pro, which is like it's a 4K Black Magic camera, like a bigger camera, and just larger. It's got a bit of a larger footprint, but I would take that. I would take my tripod. I would take the microphone and the audio recorder. That's it.
Who would, or what's the number of bodies that you feel you would need, not the actors?
How many actors? Like, what do you mean?
How many grips you need? How many grips you need? What kind of crew? Yeah.
I would have four, including me.
And what would their tasks be?
I would have an audio person. I would have an audio recordist, a sound recordist. And I would try to have it's tough, man.
I know, but I'm trying to create the same kind of conditions that most people have now,
as soon as you say that, my first thought is, well, I would probably try to shoot it entirely with practical light, but I still think you would probably need some, I wouldn't burden myself with lighting setups. I would try to shoot everything with practical light, but I would probably want to have a grip or a gaffer, someone that can help with a bit of light modification on set. So you're either just putting up a C stand with a bit of diffusion over a practical, or you're rolling with maybe a very small LED light just for a little bit of to use as a kicker, or to use as like a key light on one side if you're in a low light situation. But, you know, I try to keep it pretty lean. I would anyways try to keep that pretty lean. I would try to roll with just that many. I mean, on Paper, Rock, Scissors, we had me, Mark, you, and Dylan.
Yeah.
There was only four of us.
Yeah, and then the actors.
And the actors. Mark was recording audio, and you and Dylan were helping me with setups. And that was it.
So then it's fair to say that if you're a person listening to this that's saying, like, I just wish I could make some films, and you have a recording device in your pocket, you could go shoot some basic stuff, enough that you can do some of this editing that you're talking about, right?
Oh, I think you could shoot. Hey, man, there's a show on HBO right now that is absolutely hilarious. How To with John Wilson. It's this guy in New York, and he's just shooting it on his handy cam. He's just walking around New York, and he's just shooting. He's collected all this material, and then he does an episode. They're hilarious episodes about different things, and creates all these connections, shows all these connections in all this footage about that theme. So he'll like the episode's themed and then all this footage is somehow connected, or that is, if you ever, if you need an example of what one person can do, I mean, that's it. He shoots the whole thing himself and edits it, I think basically himself. There's probably a post team helping him deliver to HBO. So, you know, there might be some sound mixing and stuff like that done, but the basic core there is just him. Like,
how critical, to you in that kind of exercise is a short deadline?
Well, for me, deadlines are important because if I don't have deadlines, I end up in the situation I am now where I've attempted to recut this short film twice over the last 2 or 3 years.
Right. So it's perfection.
It's not perfect. It's like push-ups, man. It's like, I'm just, you know, I think that there's a lot of value in going back to the material and seeing what different thing you can make from the same source material.
Right.
I think, right, like the last doc I did, like the feature documentary I am about to undergo is a 90-minute cut of the material I've already cut in two other completely different formats. I've already cut the same material into a 6-part web series, and we've already cut the same material into a 45-minute doc for broadcast. So now I'm going to go back to the source material and I'm going to cut a 90-minute feature film from it. And all three of those are going to have very different rhythms. They're going to be tonally different. They're going to have a different depth of character and theme to them. The 90 minute is going to be much deeper than the 45 is. And the 45 has more character than the 6-part web series does, which is very didactic and, you know, educational. So I think there's just, look, like we couldn't shoot. I've been like stuck, you know, we've been busy working on other things, but I've been like starved for, I just finished a doc in the fall. And then the last few months I've been like, you know, I really think I need to do something different before I just jump back into the same thing again. And so, you know,
for me, this is a really important power of collage when you're like feeling like creating, but you don't have the oomph or the resources to have really finished elements. You can remix some existing things into some pretty neat chimeras, if you will. And you and Justin have this in common in that he, working digitally, will often say, come to me and say, look what I did. I mixed this plus this plus this into this other thing. What do you think?
Yeah.
What do you have to say about that, Justin? How does remixing existing work, what's your process for that?
Or probably a better example of that has been changing up the format. So if I have an older digital painting that I'm still quite fond of, what I've been doing lately is remaking the piece into a foil piece. So that's adding kind of a fifth color to the print to make it, to give it this a shiny foil layer on it, and then reprinting it that way. Or I also do paper tolling, where you take the same image, you cut it up a couple times, and then you paste it back together with like a little bit of lift between the layers, so it creates this like 3D effect. So if I'm kind of like inspiration starved or the tank's a bit empty, I can always kind of go back to other projects and remix them into different mediums as kind of a surefire way to get things going again.
Yeah, one of the things I do when I'm putting a new sketchbook together or doing something like that, I'll take some existing work of mine that didn't quite land or I'm not quite finished with or whatever, and I'll cut it up and do a paste up on the front of that. I mean, I can wave like a half a dozen of them in front of you guys right now. I'll do a paste up on a new thing I'm working on of a new composition just so that it reminds me that there's something of value that I haven't yet uncovered in that old piece. And then it helps carry it forward.
I think like also you have a different skill set now than you did when you did that piece. So maybe it wasn't working at the time just because you didn't have quite the skill set yet, but now coming back to it, you're more progressed and you've matured so you can take it to where it needs to go. Whereas before it kind of fizzled out. That happens a lot too, I think.
No test, transfusion.
Well, don't tell me a big man like you is afraid of a little needle.
I have no fear. I came for a transfusion of blood.
I'm sorry, Mr. Johnson, but you have to have a blood test. We don't hand out blood like gasoline, you know? We have to find out whether you need ethyl or regular.
What would either of you
provide as, I don't know if advice is necessarily the right word, but maybe some direction or commentary on when it's okay to abandon a piece. When is it not failure, but just learning, and it's time to move on with what you've learned?
Ooh, that's hard.
I mean, I think that's different. I think you have to learn what your signs are. You know,
at a certain point. Okay, so what are your signs? What do you think yours are?
It was just like with this particular short with Paper Rock Scissors, which I knew what the missing element was. I just didn't, you know. Actually, to be honest, I abandoned it. Like, I abandoned it a year ago. Like, I wasn't going to go back and recut it because I thought there was fundamental problems with it.
Which is what you had told me when I'd asked you. I'm like, so what is ever going to happen to that? Well, it was a good exercise, but I think it's dead now.
Yeah, I thought it was just dead. Like, I just thought it was missing crucial shots. I thought it was missing crucial plot points. I thought it was missing all this crucial information that the audience needed to know. And then... and so I just walked away from it because it just, you know, it had already lived a certain life. Like, it had already existed. It played at a film festival. It was there. It was 3 minutes long. You know, it got honorable mention for art direction, you know, like, it already kind of had a thing. So it was easy for me to sort of let it go. But at the same time,
point out that it was basically disqualified. Wasn't that the one that was disqualified?
Yeah, I think we were basically sort of disqualified because they thought we hadn't shot it all in 48 hours. But,
they were just that impressed?
No, I just think that...
hard to believe that we could pull that off in 48 hours.
And to be honest, you know, we did dress a set on Thursday night. So I'm fine with being disqualified. I don't really... It doesn't bother me. But, we, you know, everything was shot. We shot that between 5 and 3 in the morning. Everything was in the can in that period of time. Now, for this cut I'm working on now, I went back a year later and I did pickups, right? I brought Chris back, the actor, and he looked exactly the same. He had the same hair and everything. So I thought we needed some connective tissue to get our character into the interview, into the building, into, you know, and I thought we could do something just here at my office space. So we did, and that stuff is awesome. I didn't know how I was going to make it work originally, but I'm using it now, and it's great. It sort of works really well. But, you know, I went back a year later and did that, and did some insert shots to try to fix it. I just always thought there was a 7-minute film. I always thought there was a 7 or 8 minute film, and I thought that at 3 minutes we had cut half of it out, and I thought that the half we cut out was actually the interesting part. Like, it was actually the stuff that really tells you what the running theme of the film is. And I think that we just cut so quickly, I forgot a lot of that. And going back through the takes and watching it again, and you know, there's some stuff I don't like that, you know, this Scorsese has a great saying. He says that if you watch your rough cut and you don't feel physically ill, then there's something wrong with you. And I think that probably translates to any sort of artistic medium. If you're like, you know, if you're not deeply ashamed and embarrassed about what you've done at a rough stage, you probably are a bit of a sociopath. Like, you probably...
you can't think it's good right from the beginning. Otherwise, you're actually not being objective at all, right?
Yeah, you're not being objective at all. You need that harsh objectivity, I think, you know.
Yeah, there's always that moment. You're incredibly excited about the potential of a project, and you're just high on what it could be. And then comes the doubt and the, oh God, it's not going to work. And why am I even bothering like that? I think that's just part of the process, no matter where you are in your career.
Yeah, I think that last, why am I even bothering, has been like, that was what I had in my head every time I would sit to try to rework the short. Like, why am I even doing this? Like, why does it even matter? Like, and enough times that's sort of won over, and I'd be like, yeah, like, I don't need to be doing this. There's other things I could be doing that would be more productive than me sitting here and trying to make this work. But I think that's the hardest. Those are the hardest.
A bit of a synchronicity or serendipity that caused you to go back to it again, right?
Yeah, I was like really fighting with it, and I had just been thinking about it again, and I just finished this doc, and I was just sort of like, maybe I'll just try. Let me just see if I can give it another shot. Let me just see if there's, you know, I had some ideas about how to maybe get it to work. And then, and I fought with it for a weekend and like, just got, I was like, I fought with it for a weekend and just got, forget it. I'm not gonna, you know, went that whole week. And then the next like Saturday morning, I was listening to podcasts. And I, you know, you're getting those, I see my whole feed, and there's a podcast that I don't often listen to. It's just in my feed. And they were doing an episode on that Roger Corman film, Not of This Earth. And so I'm like in the shower listening to this podcast, and I'm like listening to all this backstory and what Corman was known for. And they're talking about the film, and I'm suddenly remembering all these, like how the film sort of lines up sort of visually with what we ended up shooting. And there's all this stuff. And then I was just like, the fact that that was on the podcast, and I was just kind of pissed off. And I was just like, okay, fine. I will go back today and I will give it another shot.
You were annoyed at the universe pointing you back in that direction.
I was like, okay, fine. I'll go back and I'll just give it another shot. And I went back, and the first thing I did was I just tried to find music, because that to me, I had this nagging idea that if I had the right music, I could make this work, because I felt like there was a subtext to the film that wasn't being communicated in the footage. I wanted the audience right from the get-go to totally understand the genre we were in right away. And I thought that the only way to do that would be with the music. So I just like, you know, happened upon these tracks, and it, you know, I searched and then found them, but I searched before and I'd never found anything and tried all different things. And then finally I found these three tracks and they worked. And next thing I knew, over a couple weekends, I had half of it cut. And then my computer almost burned the office down last week. So I had to take it into the shop. And now I'm at a point where I have to now think I can't work on it for another week and a half till I get this machine back. So
you just think about it instead.
Now I'm obsessed with it. And I'm like, I think it's actually going to work. I think I can make it work.
You will test. Then you will know and you will prescribe. You may study it in all the ways of your kind and you may learn. But you may not speak, you will not, you cannot transmit to any other being your knowledge of my tragedy.
What all three of us have in common is that we like to remix existing works as experiments. I think that's definitely true of all of our bodies.
I've always found it extremely helpful. You know?
Yeah, it's very helpful. But one of the things that I think a person listening to this can take away from it is that we have a body of work to remix, that rather than think about it, and then when you feel that moment of discouragement, we don't start. We start lots of things, and sometimes, and many of them don't work, and they pile up as piles and piles of not working, which is why I asked the question, how do you know when something is a lesson and not a failure, right? And I've gotten into the habit of looking at my failures as lessons. And you revisit a lesson. That's how you get good at something, right? You listen to the same lesson over and over again. And so that's what I try to do when I'm doing things like that. I'm wondering if either of you have comments on that topic.
Well, I've always thought that failure, like, you're not, I've always learned more from, the failures than the successes. The failures are what seem to stick, you know.
They hurt.
Well, so not remember. The failure itself, but the solution. Like, now that you know this, like what you did wrong, that sticks, you know, and what you could have done to make it right, that sticks.
Yeah, the oh, if onlys.
Those successes that were, you know, apart from, you know, it's like the failures and the happy accidents. That's what I remember on every project. Yeah.
And I think it really takes away the sting that we have so many, like you were saying, Greg, we have so many irons in the fire. There's so many ideas that are in different stages of development. Like, because that book or that long project didn't work out, it's not as devastating because we have 5 others coming out in the next couple of years and 20 others planned. Like it's a stepping stone, but it wasn't the entire focus of all our creativity, right? It's just a part of it.
Yeah, absolutely true. If I had let the pandemic get to me, the fact that I had 3 canceled graphic novels that were 80% finished before they stopped being a thing with other publishers, that could really crush a person, I think.
Delayed or canceled?
Well, 2 of them canceled, 1 of them delayed, but delayed until the world recovers enough that it makes it a viable plan. So who knows really how long that will mm-hmm. be. You know, there's a bunch of business things that are related to that I won't go into on this podcast, but it helps that I had structured it so that I own them after. So when it got canceled, rather than be canceled and lost in limbo forever, the labor reverts to me. So something I arranged so that it's not as sharp of a sting. I know I have this book that I can finish now and put out myself when the world is new again. But irrespective of that, the ideas that we had lots of other projects on the go meant that when those things stopped being my focus, I was able to say, okay, what is the thing I can focus on that needs that attention? And you pivot towards that thing. I've never been a person that starts one project, goes all the way to the end, finishes it before they start a new one. And honestly, if I was that kind of person, this year probably that would have been the end of my creative brain. Because, right, just that much disappointment heaped on a 12-month period would be too much for me. I don't think I would have been able to handle it. So past me and my frantic, schizophrenic creativity had made so many piles of things that I said, okay, fine, then this is the thing I'll work on now, right?
Yeah.
And the Moon Patrol project came out of that. It was like, okay, well, I'm going to learn how to do this thing and I'm going to make this book instead because for the first time ever, I have enough time to do it. Right.
And where, yeah, I was going to bring that project up because that's something that you didn't necessarily have a plan for, but you've put hundreds of hours into it now.
Well, maybe.
How are you dealing with that? Yeah. How are you dealing with that? Like, oh God, what happens when this is done? Is it going to work?
See, the thing is, okay, well, that project, the Moon Patrol project, did the one thing it most needed to do. Remind me that there are an infinite number of new skills that I can learn as an artist, that I'm capable of learning those skills and applying them and having fun doing it. So that's why I undertook this project. I'm going to draw 90% of it on a tablet. I've never used a tablet before. I've never drawn with a tablet using one of these pens that doesn't have, to me, that was always madness. How you worked, I thought was insane, right? But it was also very effective. And I often thought, is there a way I can apply what I'm doing to this new technology? Let's try it, right? It takes time to learn it and you need time to fail to get proficient. But the other thing it does is it allowed me to create, you know, in this case, a 300-page black and white little graphic novel that we can kickstart, I can put out, I can print myself, I can shop around. Whether anyone likes it or not, it did the thing it needed to do. Kind of like when we shot the first love song or we shot Paper, Rock, Scissors, what it needed to be was a short-term goal. For a 48-hour film, you have to make a film in 48 hours. If you do that, you can pat yourself on the back and say, I've done the impossible already. That's what I told myself. I'm going to learn a new skill in a very short amount of time and see if I can apply it. So it did that for me already. Anything else that happens now will be applying what I know about the market forces that exist in a world of book publishing. Right? This would be a different set of skills, which, you know, you and I have gotten pretty good at doing. So I'm not too worried about that part. I am hypercritical about what the final pages look like and are they any good? But I'm okay with people hating it because for me, it served a different purpose. I've said many times that bookmaking should be considered a self-archaeology, that you should be looking for something in yourself while you're working on it, so that if you find that thing, even if the book is a failure, you come out with something for all that time. So it's accomplished that for sure. And even as a dad, to show my own kids who are here, you know, in lockdown with me, dad's going to learn how to do a new thing, right? Instead of being the father who is good at the things that he's undertaking and trying to show as an example, instead I'm showing them things I'm learning how to do and talking through all the ways in which I'm trying new things and showing them things that aren't working. And you know, the frustrating part was in the first couple of months is that my oldest son was already grasped the concept of how to use collage elements with hand-drawn elements in the digital space. He grasped it so effortlessly and created an image using the techniques I'd been spending 6 months to learn in like an afternoon. He's like, look what I made, Dad. And that actually was a really great moment, you know, like I wouldn't trade. There's not much I'd trade away for that moment. So, you know, you have to understand why you're undertaking. The reason to make something and the purpose to make something are not the same. Mm-hmm. Right? Selling a book, the purpose of a book in the free market economy is for the book to generate money. The reason to make the book and the purpose the book exists are not the same thing. And you should, as an artist, separate those two things very carefully so that you understand what you're disappointed about. If you have a book that you, the reason to make it was to evaluate some part of yourself, and you've done that, when it goes into the market, if people aren't buying it or aren't connecting with it or whatever, that doesn't matter because you made it for a very specific reason. If it does, well, then that's obviously a benefit to you. But as long as you keep making things and you keep putting things in the pike, my dad has this example he uses, is that you should think of all of the efforts you put into anything as a very, very long pipe, right? And there's a busy highway between you and the other end of that pipe, and the pipe goes under the highway, right? And there's someone waiting on the other side, another version of you waiting on the other side of the highway, which you can't communicate with because it's too dangerous to go over land. So you keep putting things into the pipe, small things into the pipe, and you keep putting them in, and what it does is it pushes the first thing along the pipe, and then it starts coming out the other end to that future version of yourself. And you sometimes even forgotten the moment that you put it in, but as long as you keep putting things in the pipe, things are going to keep coming out that other end, right? And I think of my creative process that way, is that it's okay if this book or that drawing or that thing or that story or that script or that play or that whatever doesn't reach a critical audience, because it's not for the audience. Those are the people on the highway. It's for the guy on the other end, the future version of yourself that has to look at it and evaluate it and see, did it have meaning, right? So that's a very long-winded answer to friendly question, but that's sort of where I'm at with Moon Patrol, which is, you know, ostensibly a book about a robot fighting dragons on the moon. Like, it doesn't sound that deep because it ain't, right? But
they don't all have to be.
Yeah. Right. So you just, you know, your reasons and your purposes are different. Gentlemen, I've greatly enjoyed our conversation on this episode of Super Pulp Science. Thank you for sharing how you take the pieces apart and put them back together again to make a story. This is Gregory Kamichuk encouraging you all to join the fight, make comics, but whatever you make, just make lots of it.